the importance of getting out on Election Day, because we know that President Biden has made significant progress in terms of who has been appointed to the court. Courts matter, right? They hear the cases that impact our everyday lives. Here, there is a panel of three judges, and there were two judges, Judge Newsom and Judge Luck, who ruled in favor of the injunction. And then there was one judge appointed by Clinton, I believe, who wrote a very lengthy dissent. So the two judges who found in favor of the injunction, they found that the plaintiffs here had standing. And then the judge who was appointed by Clinton and wrote a very lengthy dissent disagreed. He disagreed very strongly and found that here they did not have standing because they did not make the adequate showing to demonstrate that they actually suffered some kind of injury. And so, again, you know, I'm grateful for all of the work that Barbara has done to advance voting rights because they are so critically important. Our organization has done a lot around judicial nominations to ensure that the judges who are appointed, who are nominated, reflect the great diversity of this country, that they reflect the diversity in terms of experience, that they have experience doing civil rights law, working on behalf of workers, working on criminal justice issues. Those are the types of experiences that we need to have on our courts today, because when we're dealing with issues that impact the communities that we serve, we need judges who understand these issues, both from a personal perspective, but also from a perspective of how these issues impact the day-to-day lives of real people.
Yes, and let's talk about this, because I thought it was fascinating that, you know, Rosenbaum and the opinion and the dissent, really took to this question of standing. And everybody who's listening, just think about this. You just can't walk into the court and say, I want to sue my neighbor because I don't like their plants. they got all these purple plants and I'd rather they be pink. You can't do that. You know, you got to have a grounds, some kind of real controversy, some kind of real dispute. You got to have, real injury. You got to have, standing. Standing is the ability to actually allege in court a real case or controversy, and in order to prove that, you got to prove some sort of personal real injury that causes some form of damage to yourself. Now, for those of you who have been following the news, you know that there was a major Supreme Court case that just came out involving in vitro fertilization, IVF, and the question of the, the drug milestrone, and whether or not you could use this, if this drug that, induces abortions was could be legally, sold and legally doctors could administer it. Now, the doctors who brought the case alleged that they were injured because, and the court said in the ruling and throughout the case, not because they disagreed with the argument and the position of these doctors, but they said that they couldn't show any injury, that they couldn't show standing. That whole case is about standing. And standing is not a doctrine that is just, there. It is fundamental. It's a prerequisite in order to have a case heard. So what do you think, based on this new ruling, does it impact the Fearless case at all?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you bring up standing because clearly the Fearless Fund case has gotten a lot of attention. It's still at the preliminary injunction phase, so it's still at a very early stage in the litigation. And the case still has to be heard on the merits, right? So
right.
There's likely more to come. So I think that it's very important to make that clear that this is at a very early stage in the litigation. The second thing is that after the SFFA ruling, which is about to have its one-year anniversary, last year when the Supreme Court issued the ruling in the Harvard and the UNC cases undermining affirmative action at those two specific schools, but obviously that ruling had a much broader implication for not only higher education admissions, but we saw a very broad effect on sectors outside of higher education. And so we saw an uptick in litigation and lawsuits on behalf of white men, alleging reverse discrimination against programs designed to benefit Black communities and communities of color, including this case against the Fearless Fund. But there have been others. There have been cases filed against a program involving Progressive Insurance that similarly provided grants to businesses led by people of color and by Black people. There were lawsuits filed against Amazon that had similar grant programs. And what I want your listeners to know is that while the Fearless Fund case has been getting a lot of attention in the media, these cases are having mixed success. Many of them are being tossed out of court on standing grounds. The case that was brought against Hello Alice and Progressive Insurance, that case was tossed out on standing. There are a couple of cases involving Amazon. Those cases, too, have been tossed out on standing because the plaintiffs have not been able to show that they suffered an injury. And so I think that in this moment, we need to kind of just really be mindful and, you know, understand the entire landscape and realize that they are not having success in many cases. Another case that we were involved in is a case that was brought against the Smithsonian Latino Museum, where it's alleged that they had a program. The program was designed to support the development and representation of Latinos in the museum industry, because there is a significant underrepresentation of Latinos in that industry because of systemic exclusion and barriers to entering into that field. And so the museum created this program, and they did not consider race. They did not consider ethnicity. But plaintiffs, because they saw that the majority of the folks getting the fellowships and internships were Latino, they assumed that there was something else going on, that there was intentional discrimination, and they filed a lawsuit. Well, we partnered with Latino Justice and other organizations serving Latino very quickly, Latino communities very quickly. We filed an amicus brief in that case to not only highlight that this is a program that makes its selections without regard to race or ethnicity, but also that we need programs like this. We need programs that are very intentionally designed to address the systemic barriers that Black folks, the Latinos, and other communities that are underrepresented in our country, so that they can receive the same opportunities as those who have not been historically excluded, so that they can gain access to economic opportunities to continue making progress from an economic perspective, so that they can support themselves, their families, and their communities, so that they can bring their full selves to their work and really make our country better. At the end of the day, this is what this is about, right? It's about ensuring that our democracy is as strong as possible, ensuring that our country is as strong as possible. And we can only do that if we dismantle the barriers that have existed for far too long in our country. And we're going to continue fighting. We know that this is a new legal landscape, but we're going to keep fighting with all of our tools in our toolbox to ensure that programs like the Fearless Fund program and others can continue to persist.
Well, I love thank you for that analysis and for sharing with people all the fights that have been going on. I want people to understand one thing about the Fearless Fund case. This was all private money, right? This was not governmental funds. This was not an allegation involving state action in the sense that this was a state or governmental entity providing any assistance to African-American women. These were Black women who got money from Black women to support Black women. And this was the attack. Now, since the case, I've gone online and I've been looking at the Irish funds, the Italian funds, the German funds, all of these other funds that exist to help other racial and ethnic groups in this country that are, I'm talking about, you know, U.S. Based funds. And it's interesting that Ed Blum and his crew are only attacking Black and Brown, Black and Latino. They're not attacking these funds. They haven't raised one iota of concern about all these Irish, all these Italian, all these German, all these, I'm serious, Swedish. You go by the, you go down the line, there are ethnicity funds everywhere in this country. And they haven't challenged one. What do you see about the, you know, to me, there is racism, you know, in the way that they're targeting this. And I just, you know, have one other question for you, because I know that we're running short on your time. But I just really, you know, wonder, how do you feel when you look at that, about the fact that they're only targeting a certain, you know, disfavored people, apparently?
I think you're absolutely right that these lawsuits are clearly anti-civil rights. They're clearly American. They are trying to nullify the progress of the civil rights movement. Even beyond that, I think that their goal is really to deter, to scare folks into eliminating these programs. Their goal is to bring us back to a time where many Black people, communities of color, women and others were excluded from being able to compete and participate on equal terms. And we cannot allow that to happen, right? Their goal is to scare, to frighten, to deter. And we have been doing a lot of work to engage in outreach, engage in education, to really inform folks that, look, the SFFA case dealt with higher education admissions. It dealt with one public institution, and it dealt with one institution receiving federal funding, right? That case does not change the law in other areas, right? And so the cases that they're now bringing under laws like Section 1981 that is aimed to prohibit discrimination in contracting, cases that they're bringing against programs in the workplace, et cetera, the SFFA did not change the law in those cases. And their goal is really to silence any discussion of racism, to silence efforts that are aimed to remedy discrimination. And we know that after George Floyd's murder, we saw an unprecedented movement that resulted in businesses making unprecedented statements in support of racial equity. And now, not surprisingly, a few years after, we are seeing attacks on the progress that we were starting to see in the past few years. So I totally agree with you. And I think that's why it's so important for us in this moment to just be all hands on deck and to really think strategically and to be just as organized as they are to ensure that we continue to open doors for folks who have been historically marginalized, who have been historically excluded. Our country cannot afford for us to go backwards. We simply cannot afford it. So we will continue to do everything that we can to ensure that progress continues to happen.
Before we let you go, I think, of course, that this court got the whole issue of contracting wrong, granting and contracting aren't identical. You know, they are different. And there is no, even when I was going through these other funds, I saw that every one of them had a requirement that the recipient do this or do that, you know, publicity wise or acknowledgement wise. I mean, there was all kinds of, you know, some kind of, you know, post grant activity. So I thought that the whole contracting argument that they made was absolutely insufficient and wrong-headed. But in any event, what should our audience do? Because they're going crazy. They're writing me. They're writing Daryl. They're all over social media saying this is horrific, it's horrible. What do we do? What would you suggest to our audience that they do to address this terribly unjust case?
Yeah, we've been calling on philanthropy to continue leaning in to support